I'd like to start by thanking the University, University of the Arts, for asking me to be part of the first series of inaugural professorial lectures. As you can imagine, this whole event has raised a number of questions for me, the main one being, what does it mean to inaugurate a professor? It sounds a bit like barbecue. So, like a good academic, I go to the dictionary, and the first question I ask myself is, what is an inaugural? It turns out, according to the dictionary, it marks the beginning of a new venture series, the inaugural run of the Pony Express. Well, I do feel like I'm at the beginning of trying to find new routes to deliver design against crime as socially responsive design, and that over the last 7 years, it's been a very, very fast track. Next one was worse. What's a professor? Oh, dear. A teacher of the highest rank, Stephen Hawking's. Few of us can be Stephen Hawking's. But the traditional professor, actually, the research professor, known from popular TV and film, is actually associated with displays of obscure cleverness. Many of us who've met the research professor like that, who delivers obscure knowledge and has baffled us, remembers it to our cost. In teaching others and delivering research, I've tried to be a translator. I've tried to make information interesting and accessible. This is because I fell in love with ideas a long time ago, and I've always wanted to pass on that love of intellectual ideas to others rather than to put people off from finding out information. And I see the old-fashioned model of the professor as precisely that, somebody who researches information and translates ideas and develops new theories in a way that young artists and designers can have access to, not somebody who baffles you with their cleverness, somebody who inspires them and serves them with information rather than presenting the mystifying face of the academy, which brings me to my first clip.
Listen, he actually said, what is assonance?
Really?
Honestly, he didn't have a clue what assonance was.
Come in. Come in. For God's sake, come in.
I'm coming in, aren't I? It's that stupid bleeding handle on the door. You want to get it fixed?
I obviously identify with Rita, but to see yourself as a person who can understand and learn is not always easy for some people. Educating Rita by Willie Russell, ostensibly a reworking of the Pygmalion myth with Julie Waters and Michael Caine, arrived at the cinema in 1983. A year later, I'd not only survived life at Middlesex, but gained a degree in this thing called cultural studies. The film's account of Foucault's notion that power and knowledge are connected hit all the spots for me. The thing is that those of us who were not born to imagine that we would know, those of us who struggled to educate ourselves, perhaps our gift is that we still have the capacity to remember learning how to learn. Looking back, I would have killed, absolutely killed, to have had access to Google, the search engine. But even without Google, I found education and definitions weren't as difficult as I imagined they might be. Those memories, I hope, will enable me to make it less painful for others to make the same journey. And teaching at CSM and researching here, I've enjoyed finding creative ways and means to inspire others towards real intellectual curiosity. I've always loved the ideas of looking across disciplines. And my luck was that cultural studies was very strong in this sense. But not everyone saw it that way or saw the interdisciplinary focus as a positive thing. As you can see from the quote that I've just shown you, Harold Bloom thought that the notion that one can study television or novels and get a degree and be perceived as learned without reference to Shakespeare or Einstein, well, it was truly the end of civilization. All those objects Bloom condemns as second-rate, I remind you, are designed objects, visual forms that he seems not to notice are valued more for their written content, valued more for their visual than their written content. How Bloom makes such a knee-jerk dismissal of the power of visual communication and design is typical of those who think they know and simply don't, which is why I think cultural studies and its ability to contextualise the visual as an account has contributed very much to art and design education in Britain. And while Middlesex, well, at least 20 years ago, was such an important institution, a hotspot of teaching and learning in regard to this subject. In 1981, I found myself on the former Sassoon estate at Trent Park, a 75-acre green estate between Oakwood and Cockfosters, complete with Mansion House. It was like an advert. Cedar trees and a beautiful lake to look out from the library windows. For me, it really was a radical experience, not just to have access to daffodils, but more significantly, to have access to so many ideas and debates. I was 24, and as Barry said, I'd already been a publisher's assistant and a Sogatz shop steward. I resigned from the publishers because I was worn out from negotiating other people's redundancies. That smooth-talking criminal, Robert Maxwell, took over the company, oops, and then the pension scheme, before he was stopped. So I arrived at Middlesex Poly on a grant, worried about my mortgage because I'd already married and found myself studying cultural studies among a strong cohort of fellow students who, despite Mrs. Thatcher's era, where greed was encouraged in loads of money sort of way, despite those powerful ideologies, many of us who gathered there believed we could change the world, we could make things better. All the ideas I engaged with at Middlesex, notions about making interventions in ideology to promote change and a better way of life, stayed with me when I was writing journalism, and there was lots of it just to earn a living, and working, you know, as a part-time freelancer for feminist publishing houses. I used to read The Slush Pile and was editor at New Submissions at the Women's Press. Luckily, I got a scholarship to do an MA at the University of Kent, and my dissertation turned into a book. The Female Gaze, edited with Margaret Marshman, came out in 88 before I was 30. It contained much of my MA dissertation, plus essays written by a number of the women I studied with at Middlesex and Kent. This was my first experience of collective work, and it was an important one, because it took many perspectives to make the case against this thing called gaze theory. Gaze theory had previously positioned women as objects of the male gaze, and together the writers in this book tried to change that account. I'm proud to say the Female Gaze continues in print today, 20 years on from its initial publication. And a number of the women who wrote it are in the audience tonight. I'm really pleased that you're here. The book used images from popular culture to make simple and complex arguments about representation, linked to class, race, and gender and generation issues, ideas about how and why women view popular culture as active rather than passive spectators. Some of the articles had a lot to say about these people called new men, that were evidently out there, as well as the subject of changing models of masculinity seen from a woman's point of view, or relationships seen from a woman's point of view. Suzanne Moore, one of the writers, and actually my very good friend, not only wrote for the book when no one thought she could write, but also became a recognised columnist and critic, celebrated elsewhere. She also collaborated with Janet Leigh, another contributor to the book, who went on to direct Channel 4's The Late Show before producing Yentob's Imagine series. Janet inspired Suzanne to tell us a bit more about what women want from men, and as usual, she was insightful. I couldn't resist this clip.
I tried to boil down what it is I want from men, and I've worked it out now.
Have you got a shopping list?
it's sex.
Yep.
And the kind of intimacy that goes with sex that you don't have from your female friends, and DIY.
Many of the women who wrote for the Female Gaze with me were also in their late 20s, mature students, often fractionally employed elsewhere to get through college. None of us were exactly Oxford or Cambridge people. Most of us not from public school backgrounds that go on to shape the world. In fact, most of us represented the first generation of their families to actually make it to university. The fact that so many of us who wrote for the Female Gaze have gone on to make a contribution to the media and the arts. Some of the women in it have become family barristers, run organisations, written loads of books. It gives me great optimism, all of them important in their own right, but to single out just one more, I want to make a point about Anne Treneman. I hope you're here, Anne. I know you had to work late. Anne Treneman, who is now a journalist at the Times after writing on all things menstrual taboo, Anne Treneman went on to become the first political sketch writer for any British newspaper. And that film, Her Gaze at the World, fills me with real belief that change can happen if equal opportunities in education occur, and more importantly, that talent is recognised. Many of the first-time essay writers in our book were from Middlesex or mature students, and perhaps this testifies to the quality of the interdisciplinary teaching at Middlesex and Kent universities, and the tutors who taught us and inspired us. You've met Barry, he was my tutor, Judith Williamson, Lorne Fleming, as well as Barry, Frances Mulhern, Claire Pajakowski, Clive Bloom, Margaret Marshman are just a few names that should be mentioned tonight with a big thank you. Many of them have continued to mentor me years after they stopped being paid to do so. I should also say that I'm not at all sure the people I've mentioned tonight who wrote for the Female Gaze and who were students with me would have even got an education if it were not for full maintenance grants. So Middlesex was important to what I do now because cultural studies offers the best body of knowledge and theory for young artists and designers to draw upon, precisely because it is interdisciplinary. It certainly got me thinking and writing. In 1989, I gave a paper at a design history seminar, and I met the wonderful Caroline Evans and Minna Thornton. Caroline recommended me to Central St Martin's as a tutor, and I've remained here since. The best thing about teaching here, for me at least, is that cultural studies and contextual studies are not fixed, but instead created and invented by the staff and visiting tutors here, who are simply wonderful. Even when I accepted a full-time job with BA Product Design and MA Industrial Design in 92, I was still able to create my own design teaching curriculum rather than be forced to teach a set curriculum. Contextual studies staff were also unusually located in studios and encouraged to participate and generate design briefs and projects. The drafts of books I've written, for example, Female Fetishism, written with Miriam Mackinnon in 1994, found their way into my seminar series on social and sexual subcultures. Students responded to these ideas about fetishism and eating disorder, not just with essays, which informed my thinking, but also with their own practice. These shoes are by Hedley Roberts, who visioned women's perverse compulsion to buy shoes before the series that you know did it. Dean Hollowood took vegetables and a perverse look. I found interesting. Kelly Harrison put sweets on the outside of a corset to remind us that dieting is an invisible corset. So many women are always on a diet. Our book said, look at women's relationship to food to understand how women's perversions are different from men. I'm summarising wildly. A lot of it was engaging with psychoanalytic debate. But Female Fetishism said that women can have men and they can have sex. What they're not supposed to have is chocolate. And that's why representations of women, especially size zero fashion representations, have a perverse implication. Women who try to be a fictional or unrealistic body shape, slaves to image, behaviour beyond addiction, are in trouble. And so I was thrilled when Estelle Reldon at the Portman Clinic, expert on perversion, agreed with Mary and I that anorexia and eating disorder constitutes more perverse behaviour than anything you can do in the bedroom. I'm hoping the university's Fashion, the Body and Material Culture Research Centre in due course will turn their attention to this issue, which now affects men as well as women, as John Prescott has told us recently. It'd be wonderful to see Britain's foremost fashion colleges with all the imaginative creativity at our elbows go for it on this troublesome issue. Which brings me to queer viewing. Other students engaged with the queer focus of the fetish books attempt to dismantle psychoanalytic ideas about normalcy and deviance. These students were present at conferences I helped organise with staff like Gavin Bart, now at Goldsmiths, and my friend Caroline Evans. We did the conference Troublesome Visibility here at the Cochrane, also preaching to the perverted conference series at the ICA and at Brighton Museum. Look, it wasn't just us, okay? There was a post-punk context, and designers were putting rubber everywhere, on clothing, on furniture, with serious commercial implication. After the book came out, I knew the subject was more popular than I originally imagined because I found it possible to buy S&M clothing at M&S. In the early 90s, I was teaching product design and really started to appreciate the value of visual images. Our student at CMSM and the uni speak over 157 languages from many nationalities, and I found it impossible to teach without a strong visual focus. Indeed, the accentuated visual focus here was different from how I'd taught before at Goldsmiths and Middlesex. For me, it involved far more picture research. So I took my friends Peter Booth and Martin Tothill, who were industrial designers, to work with me delivering contextual studies to product designers here at CSM. The deal was I gave them my lectures. They helped me further develop visuals and my design thinking, which was very infantile, they told me. I also want to mention my work with Dal Russell, who's stuck on a plane, because she just rang, on the MA Industrial Design course when Jan Barrett, now our dean, ran it. It was such fun creating lectures with someone else who came at the subject from a completely different angle. Dal is a brilliant consultant, a brilliant design catalyst for industry, and she enjoyed this because she found it her day off, I think, and she produced such fabulous visuals, I couldn't wait for the next slide or the next seminar. We became friends from that moment and spent years watching students respond to our accounts of design and broad social themes by sort of creating quite dysfunctional products. I'll just show you one of them. I think that the point was that the students really did interrogate consumer culture and try to challenge it. Here's a product from that period by Anna Meir, a former MA industrial design student and a very, very well noted and established designer based in Barcelona. She wrote her dissertation on subversion, and her frigid fridge reinvented the modernist white cube fridge as a vagina. Guess where you put the wine? It nearly got me sacked. Margaret Buck, our former head of college, and not my number one fan at the time, was heard to say when looking at it, there was far too much gender occurring in product design, and something needed to be done about it, or Lorraine, and to move on quickly. My intellectual focus and interest in postmodern deviance that challenged the straight lines of less is more modernism meant I spent a lot of the 90s talking about playful and perverse objects like these. And here's some more. For some reason, I just couldn't look at the classical top on that skyscraper without thinking it must be pastiche. I don't understand now why I found that so exciting at the time, but I just did. Also, this building, James Wine's Indeterminate Facade, a postmodern joke about architecture, featured in many architectural books and discussed at the time, a good visual joke the first time seen, but not one I'd want to live with or look at every day, but it didn't stop me showing it to the students. And then I was obsessed about modernism and postmodernism, or why kitsch as the opposite of beauty should be distinguished from camp, and why this, well, what this shoe meant, or seeing it as the artistic rubbish rejected by modernism absolutely compelled me to make other accounts. So I looked at Michael Graves' kettle with that red whittle, little whistle on the top, which may emphasize the noise of the kettle, and I thought, okay, this may be functional in form in harmony, but it's as camp as hell. And then there was Nina Saunders' impregnated furniture. I love the postmodern challenge to modernism that came from all the disciplines, not just from architecture or industrial design. Subversion was the order of the day everywhere, and as always, in fine art. In product design, which is traditionally a more conservative discipline because cost of tooling up a production line is so much more expensive than running up a dress. And that's why it's slightly more conservative. But the students weren't having any of it, and they wanted to make sure design moved on from the grey, black box feature of the 1980s to full bright and luminous colour everything, from tellies to toasters. This was very radical at the time. I know it might not seem like now. Now, in the eight or so annual Milan trips I made during the 90s with BA Product Design to go around the studios, and by the way, I should say that Central St Martin's BA Product Design course is 70 years of age this year, which is a big deal. At first, I found the home of Italian design and Memphis furniture exciting, but as each year passed, I started to find it really predictable. The studios and the factories that delivered the playful postmodern objects, and even what my friend Steve calls the chair fair, the Isoloni, started to get on my nerves. It was all spectacle, and the playful postmodern design responses I saw around me didn't shatter anything or subvert anything. In fact, in design terms, I started to become really angry with things like bloody Philip Stark's lemon squeezer, which didn't work, Juicy Salif. It didn't function or meet any real needs unless you're in a feminist in a novel wanted to kill somebody with it, or even make any sort of valid social comment. And, you know, I don't really know how to explain it, but I saw the design around me becoming very mediocre, and I didn't want that for our studios. Of course, there was good stuff around, products with attitude that brought a smile, or made actually valid social commentary. And here's some of the work by our own staff designers. that has a similar postmodern or situationist emphasis that I find rather good. Well, Inflates, Egg Cup, just made me laugh. Professor Ralph's table made of the cleaning squirt packages you're going to need to keep it clean, I thought was hilarious. And the streetwear that makes social comment by Vex Generation, the Vex Parker parodied riot gear and made the point through mirroring how the police dressed when they were attending the average nightclub that they were rather overdoing it. I still think the design that questions society is important. I'm actually a really big fan of what Tony Dunn and Fiona Ray at the Royal College have been doing. And I love this table that you can just, this is your desk, and you can just hide in it if anyone comes in you don't like. I want one. But the problem for me was planned obsolescence. You know, many of the objects I saw in Milan and everywhere, you know, they're just going to end up as landfill crap, really. And too much, I think, to simply enjoy. Worse, the designs from the 90s, a lot of them failed to me, in my mind, to compete with 60s innovation in aesthetic terms. It's very hard to position because there's so much from the 60s and so much from the 90s. So I just took two things I quite liked. Where is the Bridget Riley influence on design, you know, from the art in the 90s? Where is the Rolls-Royce engine's contribution to engineering? You know, this engine takes so many people coordinate together that no one person could deliver it or understand it. They have to work in harmony. And I just didn't see much like this happening in the 90s that was good enough. Now, I look back at the 80s as well. The Mothercare first fold-up pushchair. This one was designed by Sebastian Conran in 1982 for Mothercare. Utilised ergonomics and performance-led issues to address real user needs. The sort of design that redefined the object by making it easier for parents to fold and store prams. For some reason, this was no longer sexy because we were all being playful. And I suppose I just got really fed up. And I went from aesthetics to ethics very quickly. And I don't really know why. It might be because, actually, if you want the truth, in 1997 I had my daughter Ruby. And I just woke up one day and decided, given the issues about climate change and sustainable economies, that the world did not really need any more designs for crappy kettles or toasters if it was going to last long enough for our children to enjoy it. So I decided I wanted design to address social problems too, like the crime problems I'd been writing and thinking about. I wanted the design that I worked on previously to make more social comment and also function, small point. But before I talk about that, well, the issues I had with user-centered designs and the need to make products that have longevity, I'd like to talk a little about somebody I met at the time. And this means I have to introduce some of that Doctor Who linear discontinuity. I want to talk about meeting the historian Raphael Samuel. In the late 80s, before I came to work at Central St Martins, I was earning a living from many sources just to survive. I was part-time lecturing at Goldsmiths and Middlesex. And my design lectures were obsessed with history, actually. I was reading Dick Hebdig's account of the Vespa. I was reading John Thackeray or Modernism and contextualising Dieter Ram's designs for Bloom and the Moment of Modernism. I loved Judith's work on advertising. Her account was very important to me, so much so I later persuaded her to be my supervisor. Angela McRobbie, too, was important. Her account of settling subcultural discontinuities in history by writing women back into the account were important to me. And then I was sent by Verso to meet Raphael Samuel because it was a freelance job and basically Raphael needed some editorial help. To cut a long story short, Raphael Samuel was an eminent British Marxist historian rated alongside E.P. Thompson and Eric Hobsbawm as one of the most significant historians of the left of our time. And when I met him, I had no idea, because he was so modest, he was so unassuming. He just told me, you know, he had a manuscript that he needed help with, and I sort of believed him. It was a sequel to The East End Underworld. As soon as I arrived with my manual typewriter to talk to Raphael about the sequel to this book, I knew he wasn't going to let me do anything. I'd been warned, but I just didn't believe them. It was because as soon as I opened my mouth, really, he virtually got out his tape recorder and started to interview me about my family history and my understanding of priming East London. His account that we live history and that popular memory has an important role to play in understanding the past really did change my life. I can see this now only in retrospect. This is because Raphael's approach to history the radical methodology at looking at working class lives really did give me a different way of looking at myself and also where I'm from. Raphael Samuel's oral history of the East End underworld, The Life and Times of Arthur Harding, was already published, as you can see. And the sequel that he never delivered was going to contain these episodic accounts of many criminals. And so when he started talking to me and we got chatting, I told him my dad had a nightclub in St. Ewington in 61. He was thrilled. Okay, let me explain. My dad had a nightclub in 61. The club was taken over by the Cray twins. Here's a picture of my mum and dad. Sorry, mum. And the club was taken over by Johnny Barry. I guess my dad was made an offer he couldn't refuse. And even though my dad wasn't around that much during my childhood, he died in 68, Raphael was still hopeful for some reason, because I had these strong links in East London and probably because of my accent, that I could get interviews with people he couldn't, who'd actually been to the club. And he didn't really want to interview criminals. He just wanted to interview ordinary people who happened to be there at the time to understand the myths that they sort of perceived. And so through Raphael's eyes, I learned to understand why the stories people tell themselves, the myths their families live with and pass on are significant, particularly crime mythologies. So Raphael's influence led me to move away from feminist theory and postmodernist accounts of consumer society to looking at female crime mythologies. I persuaded Raphael to be my PhD supervisor along with Judith Williamson and Barry Curtis. And it was through these tutorials and later taking down the life story of a professional thief that I developed an understanding of what I now call the criminal gaze, which I want to talk about. So in a nutshell, what is the criminal gaze? In my account, I suppose I describe it as the way criminals look at the world differently from others, how the bricks and mortars of their daily life of crime are normalised by simply accepting this is something that they do. Edward Sutherland, writing in the 1930s from the acclaimed Chicago School, the account of the life of the professional thief, suggests that for many criminals, crime is exactly that, just what they do, a way of earning a living. Sutherland compared their discourses, their accounts, with those of sort of undertakers, or monument salesmen, as he called them. And he said they were matter-of-fact boring in the way they represent and talk about themselves in conversation. Not inspiring them. Well, Professor Ekblom, who now co-directs the Design Against Crime Research Centre with me, uses the phrase think thief to encourage designers to think like criminals in order to design out crime and in trying to get designers to think about the people who may steal the products they design. I find this to be a very, very useful shorthand to get kids to look in that way. But having taken down the life story of Shirley Pitts, a professional thief, whose subjectivity forms the criminal gaze in the book Gone Shopping, I think it's only possible to really think like a thief when one has access to more than one type of discourse. On the one hand, designers need to understand the way the criminal sees things, the scams and perpetrator techniques they use and how they see it. On the other hand, they need to look at evidence provided not just by the thieves but also by the police, more strategically criminologies. Criminals romance and big up their stories. And in terms of developing the Design Against Crime agenda at Central St Martin's, my relationship with the Metropolitan Police and the Jill Dando Institute of Crime Science has been very significant. I've been able to measure opinion against other forms of evidence. But to get back to the gaze of Shirley Pitts, who I'd like to take a few minutes to speak about, as she was very special. I wanted to take down Shirley Pitts' story because I knew that the accounts of lives of crime by women who were not passive girlfriends or gangsters' moles, even now, are quite hard to find in the British Library. What I'm saying is that I'd known Shirley Pitts, who was a professional shoplifter. She lived near the flats where I grew up, and I knew the way she saw herself was nothing like I was reading. So I decided I could make a contribution to knowledge by taking down her story for PhD and analysing it using theoretical frameworks. Look, women commit much less crime than men, and the argument made by criminologists like Frances Hyderson is that this is because ideologies of femininity make them more compliant and therefore more law-abiding. Shirley used to come into my mum's wool shop at the bottom of Hoxton Market and openly tell stories about her trade that gobsmacked me. By the way, I worked from 10 till 20 in the wool shop every Saturday. She used to laugh at the way the men she worked with always needed to large up what they'd done, or male menace. She'd quote them. She was a fabulous mimic, and she'd say, he got saucy, quoting someone else, so I shot him. Her subversive account of shoplifting to make a living and dressing in the proceeds were absolutely mesmerising. She was a very beautiful woman, very able to pull a fast one on a lot of the men that gave them their tales of bravado. She wasn't scared either. And her look at the world, the way she spoke about her life with Prime, was like nothing I'd ever read before. And I knew because of my family connections, I knew I'd be able to get her to tell me her story. This part becomes more complicated. Okay, this is my cousin, Jeannie Murray. The way women who are criminals are represented by the media and other sources rarely captures the authentic voice. The truth is that my cousin, Jeannie Murray, who was murdered in 1977, indirectly had a big influence on the decision to go for Shirley's story. Jeannie was hardly a big-time criminal, or even really a gangster's mole. She went out with a policeman for several years before she dated Mickey Ishmael, who went on to rob the Bank of Cyprus with George Davis in 1978. It sounds so naive now, but in 78, I really wasn't prepared for what hit me when Jeannie was murdered, from what I read. I was about 20, newly married. I just woke up one morning to see all these headlines in every paper about my cousin being a gangster's mole. Some sort of revenge thing based on her boyfriend for which she was murdered. I even heard people discussing it in the really posh lunchroom at the nice middle class publishers where I worked before I went to Middlesex. And because I was silenced then and so angry about how she'd been represented, I suppose the repress had to return somehow. Meeting Raffles Samuel, persuading Shirley Pitts to tell me her story, helped me turn all that adversity into something creative. A female crime biography for Penguin. What I'm saying then is I knew when I took on Gone Shopping from my own experience that representations of women as criminals in history are imprecise and rubbish, often flawed by the male gaze at them. I could give you a long and boring criminal lecture now on the subject of women and crime, and I won't, you'll be relieved to hear. What I'm saying is I knew the way Shirley saw herself and the way women like my cousin Jeannie saw themselves, it's nothing like what I was reading or seeing portrayed elsewhere in the 90s. And I thought I could get the real story to produce a different angle, a wry look at what had been written before, as well as a fresh account. Oral history then provided a way to do that. I felt if there was to be an oral history of a woman who lived her life through thieving, then I'd get the real story, the real criminal female gaze at it, not the account that simply reinforced masculine myths. The thing is that Shirley died in 1992, and I suspect the only reason she ever told me her story is because she knew she was dying of breast cancer, and she recognised her story might provide some funds after she was dead for her seven children. It took me 4 years to write up Gone Shopping, and I did sell the film rights. Her funeral with 21 hearses was a major experience for me. So many people love Shirley. She was a very decent woman, despite what she did for a living. And the paparazzi, of course, had a field day, because the East End Underworld, so-called, were there and supplied the wreaths to commemorate her trade rather beautifully. The newspapers even rung up Sandra Rhodes and asked her, wasn't Sandra annoyed that Shirley was buried in one of her £5,000 dresses that she'd obviously stolen? Sandra Rhodes replied, to her credit, that she was honoured that Shirley had chosen her above any other designer to be buried in. And you know what? If it was the other way around, Shirley would have said the same. And for that comment, I would always love Sandra Rhodes. I've already mentioned that Raffles Samuel absolutely supported my proposal to do an oral history on shoplifting, linked to the testimony of Shirley Pitts. I applied and got the grant, full scholarship for Middlesex, with Raffle, Judith and Barry as supervisors. Raffle also later nursed me through Shirley's death and the heavy responsibility I felt in writing up what was to be the final account of her life. Shirley's account of defeating £1 million worth of security with simply a carrier bag lined with foil that when closed stopped the alarms going off and allowed thieves to get out of the shop really bothered me in design terms. What was wrong with the design of the department store if it was so easy for professional thieves to get away with it? And so simply, Shirley had only been caught twice in 50 years of thieving from shops. This fact, I would argue, is absolutely linked to the emergence and history of the shopping mall. Okay, in the past, theft involved three people, the shopkeeper, the customer, and the decoy, because you had to distract the shopkeeper to steal the stuff. When the 18th century Paris malls and the 19th century department stores emerged in Britain, people could touch and feel as well as look at things, often without permission of the shopkeeper or the staff. It's at this point in history that middle-class women begin to steal in great numbers. Not just poor women. Elaine Abelson's account of 19th century shoplifters describes how the idea of kleptomania had to be invented to explain why the judge's daughter had run off with all the stuff. The point I'm making to you is a design point. Shop theft hadn't been anticipated in design terms in the 19th century. Stores such as Harrods and Selfridges in London or Macy's in New York were designed to make people want things. And guess what? They wanted them so much they stole them. Crime is still not considered much by architects today, who design beautiful buildings that are retrofitted and made to look ugly, you know, with the security, when the architects could have done it so much better by anticipating these problems. So I started to think then, after grieving for Shirley and her death, how design and architecture could be used to deter people from stealing things. So why? Why did I do that? I think it was from Shirley's account of how she did it that I started to think about how to block crime. And why, if you want the answer, is because I could see that Shirley's life, she'd rarely been happy or settled. She just didn't know any other way to provide for her family. The women I interviewed also after Shirley died, who were shoplifters, were hardly inspiring. Unlike Shirley, was from a different generation and spent her proceeds on her kids. Many of them shoplifted simply to pay for drugs, and in so doing, helped ruin legitimate businesses and themselves just to stay in the same place or worse outfit. It's hard to explain Shirley. She had an X factor that made her almost licensed to steal. But listening to her story for so many years, I realised Shirley Pitts was a very creative person. And crime not only didn't make her exactly happy, but even the audacity of her scams didn't use up her boundless creativity. To make a design point, I think Shirley's four-line carrier bag, in its simplicity, is far more creative, even if that's an account of the dark side of creativity, than the retrofitted security systems it subverted. The point I'm making is that those systems cost millions. Shirley could have used her creativity not for crime, but to be anything she wanted. Certainly a designer, not least because she frequently drew clothing, faces, shapes. Often she redesigned the clothes she stole because she believed they weren't quite right or good enough for her clients' needs. She dressed people who bought clothes from her and who wanted to look like her. Like she was, you know, she was like she was delivering a fashion shoot if you listen to her. This made me realise many things, but the three points I want to make is one, if Shirley's mum hadn't emotionally abandoned her at the age of seven, when Shirley first started to steal to feed the family, then met all the wrong men, her life could have been different. Two, that designed environments, not just criminals, contribute to crime and are complicit with criminal intention. And three, and this one's more shocking, that designers and criminals have a lot in common, more than I ever realised. These are some of the things that I think designers and criminals have in common. They're entrepreneurs, opportunists. They use provisional, strange, sideways thinking. They're flexible. They translate ideas and skills. They're risk-inclined. And they're quite inspiring for crime and its audacity designed for its wow factor. And you know what? It doesn't end there. Let me just do the health warning again. Obviously, the difference is that criminals are perhaps more pessimistic and parasitic than designers, who believe their creativity can change the world. But what they have in common is dyslexia. Actually, some arguments suggest that 60% of art and design students are dyslexic. Similar accounts of dyslexia in prison from many countries. And guess what? Entrepreneurs are more likely to be dyslexic. I rest my case. What I'm trying to tell you is that there are some things we could do with this observation, but there's not time here to talk it through, but there's some things we could do to put something back into society linked to an observation like that. But to get back to the story of design against crime, my real job. Okay, another sort of linear historical jump into my fuzzy history timeline. It's 1997 now, and I'm working in the Department of Graphic and Industrial Design, having had 10 weeks maternity leave. And I'm delivering a project with all the other staff called Safer Cities, which my course was involved. I was also supervising individual students' anti-crime projects. In the studio, there was some support for sort of crime, but actually, they weren't that interested. And so I kept myself busy. I wrote about soap powder. There's the exhibition at the Design Museum. Delivered a catalogue. And it wasn't until 1999, really, that I was able to persuade Central St Martins to let me set up what I call the Design Against Crime Initiative. As luck would have it, Sean Homara, who co-curated Dirty Washing exhibition, was a wonderful graphic designer and is still, and basically created an identity for Design Against Crime and many graphic outputs that made the initiative look more real than it was at the time. Really, it was funding and support from the Design Council and the Home Office in 2000 that truly helped me develop the DIDAC agenda. At that time, I formed an important partnership with the Design Council and the Home Office that continues today in the form of the Home Office Design Technology Alliance, of which I'm part. Let me show you some of the work such partnerships have delivered. So, first of all, there's a design resource, which was about bag theft. I wanted to work on crimes against the person. I fed the theory to designers like Jackie Piper and Marcus Wilcox, and instead of coming up with a bag, they came up with a chair, which I thought was wonderful. Ben Hughes helped me create and deliver In the Bag and Off the Wall at the Design Museum, which included work by many product and fashion designers from the college. Fred Duthie helped Jackie, Marcus and I deliver this chair exhibition for the REBA. And the Design Council funded Don't Tempt Me, which Dale Russell and Andrew Bolton, as well as my colleagues for the Design Council, helped me get together. It was perhaps CarrySafe that was the most successful. This was the first direct project with Adam Thorpe and Joe Hunter from Vex Generation, and was estimated to have attracted about 800 grand's worth of publicity. We did loads of exhibitions with CarrySafe, and Adam Thorpe and I started to develop a research partnership that's kept us very busy. We did lots of exhibitions. I think this one, which was called The Anti-Crime Wave, is my favourite. I was working with the British Transport Police and had the opportunity to exhibit for free. We had no funds to build anything, and Adam persuaded Ansel Thompson to let us use his amazing wave, which he then helped us turn into this thing called the Anti-Crime Wave. And there we went to Victoria, where there's a million people passing through in a week. And the police from Westminster and British Transport were there with us, property marking. And the best thing about it was that the public kept coming up to us. It's small amounts of people. They kept patting us on the back and saying thank you for trying to do something about pickpockets. And then they'd go on and on about having their bags stolen. So we're trying to develop that work at the moment into a website, again, with funding from the Home Office. All the work I've showed you has been informed by a range of very strategic partnerships with the following stakeholders. You can see their logos. But I'd very much like to thank for their support, in particular the Metropolitan Police, the British Transport Police, the Jill Dando Institute of Crime Science, Transport for London, and so many others, including the Arts Humanities Research Council, who recognised and funded our work. With all this support, we subsequently won a number of design awards. I want to mention the Sir Misha Black Award, because it was given to us in 2006 in recognition of the university setting up Design Against Crime as one of its research centres. We think there's more to come. As you can see, these new anti-theft stands are going to be delivered soon. We launch them next month, designed by the designers who work with Adam Thorpe and myself as the Bike-Off team. I hope you'll see them all over London soon. Camden, Shoreditch, Brighton, Surrey have already ordered some of them. And I also hope they help reduce bike theft by helping people lock their bikes properly. We believe our work has a big impact on persuading the world that secure design doesn't have to look criminal. It doesn't have to be Rottweiler and Fortress. And that's, I think, one of our biggest achievements, because when I first started this work, actually, people were very dismissive of the notion that you could intervene. So what does the future hold from us? I feel it's to their credit that Central St Martins and the University have got behind Design Against Crime and have genuinely seen the point of trying to involve our designers in making crime prevention sexy. Also, I want to acknowledge personally the opportunities and space I've been given to deliver this work. The art house ethos that informs the university still provides space for a wide range of practitioners, researchers and other creatives who regularly use their intuition, personal experience, as well as their talent to transform sensibility into design that shapes our material reality. A place where looking awry is common. Definition of looking awry, just in case you didn't know what it meant. Not in the intended way. Seeing things from a different angle is part of the way things are done here. And because of that fact, I think it's made me feel at home in the university. I feel like not just that I fit in, but I have a contribution to make. But it's not just me. DAC, of course, has benefited from a wide range of expertise, and different perspectives and what I like to call wonky thinking. Here's a picture of some of the people who make up the DAC team, which includes many of our designers as well as criminologists from the Jill Dando Institute of Crime Science, with whom we've formed an important research relationship. Also, second on the left, you'll see Ike Gray. He's there as a representative of his colleagues and himself from the Metropolitan Police. He regularly advises us, and so do many others. They criticise our work and help us develop it. I know people at events like this go over the top when thanking their team, but I mean it when I say DAC is the product of all of us, because we really do operate like a collective on many, many levels. It's about the wisdom of crowds, I suppose. Groups are often wiser than individuals. So what's next? In the coming years, DAC hopes to develop research across new design territories. The thing is, the costs of crime are not sustainable, and many of our students now want to actually make a contribution to society. You can see the figure here from the British Council talks about young people wanting to make a difference in the world while remaining true to themselves. When I first started teaching, less than 10% of our students were setting themselves ethical projects. And now, 15 years later, as many as 50% of our students want to design not just for the marketplace, but in ways that are useful for the community. It's like butterflies flapping wings in a new direction. And I find it wonderful, which is why at DAC we talk about socially responsive design. We think design against crime and the models it's delivered has a significant contribution to make to design in the future. The research models we've developed and developing are robust enough, I think, and the team thinks, to be utilised by other ethical initiatives. But always, it's not what you do, but the way that you do it, which brings me to finally sum up why a right look at design and crime counts. I found at Central St Martins and the university that there's a richness of people who see things from a different angle, who use talent and subversion to create new meanings, new innovations, who don't look like how you might expect or come from Oxford and Cambridge, actually, but still have an influence on the world, shaping it, creating new metaphors. With the support of such creative individuals, we can deliver the We Think approach, and I truly believe the best DAC work is yet to come, and I do mean it will be our work, because DAC is a collective project and is richer for being about we and not I, in the way that Charlie Ledbetter from the Demos think tank describes in his book and website We Think. I want to end this inaugural lecture and debut by saying the right part of my gaze is not just generated by experience and ideas, but if I say so myself, also courage to face up to some people here that needed to be faced, and also to take risks in order to try and innovate and to see the world as something that can change for the better and be changed. But I'm with Emma Golden that the idea there's no point in having a revolution to change the world unless you can have a good time. And I'm pleased to announce the bar is now open. The refreshments are in the Lethaby Gallery, where there's a fab poster exhibition that you'll find there. Thank you for listening to me. And to play you out, we'd like you to watch Flight of the Conchords, a comedy duo whose account of crime and what the world needs today should remind us all why humour has a role to play in serious initiatives. Thank you.